That's right. We have one of my favorite legislators here this afternoon. Mike Pitts is with us, and if you've got a question for him, don't hesitate to pick up that phone, 229-7984. Mike Pitts, how you doing today? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too.
It's been a while. Are you glad you're back in the elected office here?
I'm glad I won the election. And this has been the fastest paced, most jam-packed few weeks of session that I've been involved in the 10 years I've served in office. This is my 11th year, and the pace this year is horrendous. It's just...
Why is that?
For me personally, it's because I have found myself in so many assignments right
You're
now.
You're so in demand.
Well, I don't know about so in demand, but maybe it's the fact that it's difficult for me to say no when they pose an issue to me. But currently, I'm serving on I chair my budget committee, and I'm serving on the new ethics committee that is rewriting the ethics rules and laws for the House, and I'm also serving on an ad hoc committee looking into unfunded and underfunded mandates to local government. So between those three and normal legislative duties and the demands of constituents, then it's been a very tough year so far.
Now, I know one of the things that they're talking about that I am surprised, they're talking about shortening the session. What do you feel about that, Mike?
If we could shorten it to about the end of February, this year I would probably vote for it. We could use a shorter session. Jeff Duncan and I went to the speaker years ago on that issue and said, why don't we structure especially the first year of a two-year session, which is where we are right now, why don't we have only the committees meet for the first month? Because there's nothing on the calendar. There's no need for everyone to be in Columbia during that time. You only need to be there when your committee needs to meet. So that would be a good shortening of the session, to simply say committees only for the first month of a new session. And if you cut the tail end off of the session and shortened it by 30 days, I don't think anybody would pay attention. I told David Wilkins I would not support a shortening of the session because it was difficult enough to get a bill passed with the time we had. But since that point in time, I've realized that the real difficulty is not in getting a bill passed, it's getting the Senate to wake up long enough to hear a bill.
God, it sounds like you're saying that South Carolina House of Representatives and the Senate is kind of like what's going on up there in Washington, D.C. Is that what you're saying, Mike?
No. Our situation is much, much better because, frankly, we have control of both houses and in state legislature. But our senators do work well for the most part, and I have a good relationship working with them. But I do like to kid them. They say they're the deliberative body, and I say they're the body that likes to sleep occasionally.
they take their time deliberating. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, they do. Well, and they have some rules that slow the process down to extreme. They can filibuster. We can't filibuster in the House. And it's very difficult to move a senator away from the podium if he wants to keep the podium. So rules over there are different than they are in the House. Plus, most of those guys in the Senate are tenured individuals, so they understand what's going on. It's harder to play. It's harder to run a game on a senator than it is on a young House member.
Okay. All right, enough said.
Is that fair enough?
That's probably fair enough. Now, you of course, we were talking earlier, and you said, of course, the issues of budget are very difficult. I didn't realize that 81% of the budget is spent on health care, number one, and education, number two, with only 3% going to law enforcement. Wow. How does that work?
It's very difficult. I chair the budget committee. Excuse me. I chair the budget committee that's responsible for all law enforcement. That includes the departments of correction, probation, pardon, and parole, juvenile justice, and the court systems. So it's very difficult, especially when in the Constitution, public safety is one of the first things stated as a core function of government.
Sure.
And with that small part of the budget to fund it, it becomes very difficult. And especially state agencies like SLED, for instance, that provides a great many services back to local law enforcement and other indirect agencies that you wouldn't think about. For instance, the coroner's office or probate court rely on SLED.
So I know you had told me earlier you actually had talked to the governor earlier in the week, and you're trying to get, I presume, more money for law enforcement. And with the ramped up issues of the guns and everything, we seem to be seeing more and more crime all around. Are you going to be able to get it?
I'm pushing for it. I met with the chairman of Ways and Means this past week, and we had a good sit down about it. And like I told you earlier, the governor and I sat and discussed the law enforcement budget, and she's fully supportive of strong funding for law enforcement because she recognizes two things. One is it is an absolute core function of government, and the second thing is the climate is not what it used to be, and I'm not talking about climate change. I'm talking about the societal climate that we now live in. It's a dangerous place out there.
It certainly has. From a time in Greenwood County where you could leave your doors open and leave your keys in your car, you wouldn't do that today.
I wouldn't.
No. Well, I don't think anybody actually is anymore. But this doesn't have to do, just for making sure this is clear, this doesn't have to do with the local county and city governments. They fund your local police and sheriff. This has to do with state.
That's correct. I'm talking about the state agencies that come under, or state law enforcement agencies that come under us, and that would be SLED, the department, DPS, which is the Highway Patrol, Transport Police, Probation, Pardon, and Parole has Class 1 officers, and the Department of Natural Resources has Class 1 law enforcement. So that's what I'm talking about. The guys that are out there standing between me, you, and the bad guys.
Absolutely. So what do you think are the biggest, okay, this is one big issue. What else do you think is a big issue out there, Mike?
Well, from the standpoint of public perception and public demands, fixing the election debacle from last year and assuring that that never happens again is one of the front burner issues.
Have we fixed it?
No, we have not. But
I thought we had.
No, we're in the process of fixing it. You have a bill coming through the Senate and a bill coming through the House. We've only been in 30 days, and government doesn't fix anything in 30 days.
Are you saying we've only just begun?
We've only
the carpenters.
And in the words of the carpenters, we've only just begun. Those bills are both working through committee process at this point in time. I just hope that we can get a bill out that is simple enough to make sense. I served on a panel this past weekend at the Election Commissioners Conference, and it's a simple issue.
What is the simple issue, Mike?
The simple issue is a statement of economic interest and the filing of it knocked people off the ballot. And I'm not sure that you even need a statement of economic interest to be a candidate. You should, once you become an elected official, you should have to file it definitely. But I'm not sure you really need one to be a candidate. And if you're going to require it, that shouldn't be a requirement that would kick an individual off the ballot that wants to run for public office, especially with the mess that it created this past year. But yes, it will be fixed. If it is not fixed, then no one in the General Assembly should be back in the General Assembly. It's that simple.
Wow. All right, we are here with Mike Pitts. We're going to be here the whole hour. Hey, if you've got a question, give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984. We'll be right back.
Gold, more precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
All right, we're back here at Sharp Facets Gallery. It is Meet Me at the Diner. Today, my very special guest, Mike Pitts. We're having a very spirited conversation off the air, and I think we should get back to it here. Let's change it up and talk a little bit about Second Amendment rights. I know you said you were going to be a speaker at the State House. They're having a rally.
Yes, there's a Second Amendment rally coming up, and I was asked to be a speaker at that rally. I have a history of promoting the liberties guaranteed by the Second Amendment, and
well, I don't know. A lot of people are saying the Constitution, you know, how can you have a document that's old that still be relevant today, Mike? How can you? I'll play devil's advocate here for this conversation, folks.
I don't think that it's an outdated document. I'm one of the people that believes that it is still a very, very legitimate document. I think it's the only thing that protects our liberties. Our founding fathers sat down and created a government based on that document with their vision, unprecedented in history. There's nothing like it in history previous to the U.S. Constitution to guarantee personal liberties, the rights of the minority within the wishes of the majority, the rights of free enterprise. There's no other nation on earth has ever been governed in that manner. And I think when you sit down and you really study the Constitution, how it came into play, the Revolution itself, and where a group of patriots went up against the strongest army and navy combined in the world, mm-hmm. and won, I firmly believe it was with divine intervention. I believe the Constitution was divinely inspired.
You know, that's exactly what Congressman Jeff Duncan said the other day.
Well, it shocks me greatly that my former seatmate and I would be on the same page.
What do you have to say to those that say, you know, we really ought to throw it out, that the Second Amendment is definitely wasn't the way it's being used today? People carrying arms and using them to kill other people and everything certainly wasn't the intention.
People were being killed at that point in history, just like they are today. You got to remember that at that point in history, when this document was written, some of our nation was still wilderness. The frontier was not very far. The frontier didn't extend to the Mississippi River in some places. So it was a perilous time. You know, and the Constitution, and I'm a purist on the Constitution and make no apologies for it. The guys that wrote that thing were extremely smart, and there was a debate as to whether the Second Amendment was going to be first or second. And they chose to put the First Amendment first because of the right. People think of the First Amendment as right on religion, but it's a right to free speech. It's a right to assemble. And if you take the entire Constitution or the amendments and you look at them, and then you ask yourself, why did they put this in place? What exactly were they thinking? Why did they guarantee in the Constitution your ability to get together and talk about politics? Why did they guarantee your right to go to the church you wanted to? Why did they guarantee a free press that could not be undermined by government? Why did they put all those things in the First Amendment? How about the Third Amendment? The Third Amendment guarantees that soldiers cannot be housed in your home. Now, why would you have to have that? Because Redcoat soldiers were being housed in the home and you were responsible for taking care of them, providing for them, you and your wife, your family. Fourth Amendment, the right against illegal search and seizure. Why was that put in place? Because they came in and searched your home, tried to find something to say that you were a traitor. Fifth Amendment, how about they put you in stocks and kept you there until you admitted to whatever they wanted you to admit to? Fifth Amendment, the right against self-incrimination, and on and on. And then that brings us back to the Second Amendment. They knew that there had to be a way for you to protect the rest of that, because it is just a document. It's words written in ink on paper. So there has to be some way to back the rest of that Constitution up. And that's the Second Amendment. People say the argument today is it's for military. It's for us to call a militia. Well, let's go back to the times again. Why was Paul Revere riding down the road yelling the Redcoats are coming? And what were they coming to do? They were coming to take the guns. They were coming to disarm the citizens of Lexington and Concord. Why? It's hard to fight back if you have no guns.
Yeah.
So what did the Minutemen do? The Minutemen fell out. The Patriots fell out. Now, that brings us to the other question. The opponents say, well, the Second Amendment's to give you the right to have a military force. That's not what it gives you the right to do.
No.
They say, well, it's okay if you have a hunting rifle or a shotgun. It's okay for you to be able to defend yourself, but you don't need certain things to do that. When the Patriots fell out, and they fell out with the most modern firearms that they had at the time, which was a musket. That matched what the Redcoats had. They fell out with those to defend their personal liberties that were being infringed by King George and an oppressive government. It was not about hunting. It was not about personal defense. Now, with that concept in mind, had they said, you don't really need a musket, but it's okay to have a bow and arrow to hunt with, I think the American Indians, the Native Americans, could tell you that that didn't work too good when you went up against
the musket. I think, don't you think a lot of the problems that we're having today as far as understanding government and everything is our lack of civics, and even in a lot of cases, American history, and even studying the Constitution and all the amendments and everything? I just don't think that our young people are prepared to understand all this.
Young people?
Old people? Adults?
One of the hardest problems I have as a legislator is getting people to understand just what is in the realm of my power and what is not. Government's government. So people think that if you're an elected official, you have access and ability to deal with all issues facing government. I get a flurry of emails every time Fox or MSNBC reports a federal bill or a federal movement. I get demands to vote against it.
And you're in the state legislature, and you're not even part of that.
That's correct.
Don't you think that is part of the problem? Why is it that civics and just understanding government has just gone by the wayside?
Because we don't teach the same level of civics in public schools that you and I had when we were in public schools. People don't know how a bill gets passed. People do not know what the responsibilities of state government is versus federal government. Well, but for that matter, I would say there are a lot of congressmen that don't understand the difference between what they have the authority to do in Washington and do not have.
Absolutely. When is this rally? Do you know? Has the date been set?
Yes, it has. It's either this Friday or next Friday. I would have to look at my calendar, and I don't have it with me.
Okay. All right. So that's going to be at the State House.
It's at the State House on Friday from 10 to noon, And I can't remember whether it's this Friday or next Friday. I hope you'll forgive me for my memory failing once.
That's okay. It's a senior moment.
It is. I will admit it.
We're here with Mike Pitts. When we come back, we're going to be talking some about guns. We're going to be talking about some of the other issues facing our state here. So I certainly hope you'll stay right with us. Right now, it is time for South Carolina News. Hey, don't forget, if you'd like to call and ask a question, pick up that phone, 229-7984. Give us a call. We'll be right back.
This is Philip Biffle, your Greenwood Edward Jones Financial Advisor. Do you have a recovery plan for your investments? If not, there are several reasons we think you should. While interest rates are very low, certain income strategies and investments could help increase your investment income. Also, many investment portfolios are out of balance at a time when proper investment diversification may be most critical. You also may want to review your portfolio to consider replacing lower quality investments with higher quality investments that may be at attractive prices. No one can control what the market will do next. You can, however, take advantage of investment opportunities that exist today. At the same time, it is important to be well positioned for whatever the market does tomorrow. Please call me, Philip Biffle, or stop by my office today to develop your personalized recovery plan investment strategy. Please call me, Philip Biffle, at 229-0444, or stop by my office today to develop your personalized recovery plan investment strategy. Edward Jones, Making Sense of Investing, member SIPC.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here, Sharp Facets Gallery. We are here with one and only Mike Pitts. And, you know, we just had a call from George Michelson. He says, why don't you set up a committee of one? You could just be in a room by yourself, Mike. And every month have a press conference announcing the biggest waste or biggest uselessness. Also wants to know, can civics criteria be required in the schools?
Yes, it can. The General Assembly can set core requirements by legislation in the schools.
So why don't we have them? How did they get out of it?
There are civics. It's just that the time requirements are not what they once were. When you and I went to school, we were taught not only American history and world history, but South Carolina history. If you were a student in South Carolina, you were taught who the Gamecock was, who the Wizard Owl was, et cetera.
Swamp Fox.
Did I leave off the Swamp Fox?
Didn't you leave off? Yes.
Francis Marion. The university, Francis Marion, a bit of trivia, and the longest game in Peach Belt history was between Lander University and Francis Marion in baseball. It was a 16-inning game played on Easter Sunday.
Oh, my God.
And the bad part was it was the first game of a doubleheader.
Wow. And who won?
We did. Lander.
Lander. Okay. All right. Great. I mean, I didn't know. Okay.
We
Excellent.
Did. 3-1.
3-1? 16 innings?
It was a 1-1 tie.
Wow. Unbelievable. You know, one of the questions that I think is out there, and I think the Super Bowl actually brought this home, was how critical and how we used to enjoy laughing and enjoying things, and now everything has to be so politically correct that businesses who work hard to come up with a concept that might create a little jolt for their benefit had to be pulled from the roster of the commercials. I think that is such a microcosm of what is happening in society here today.
It is, and my wife would tell you very quickly that it's difficult for me to be politically correct, so I don't understand it to begin with.
But that goes to our Second Amendment. It goes to everything. Everybody is just not standing up, or we have lost the ability to think for ourselves.
Well, the current administration in Washington thinks that they can think better for you than you can for yourself. They know how to raise your children better than you do. They know how to spend your money better than you do. And that's a soapbox I could get on and shout. But this country was not designed to be a nanny state. If you want a nanny state, Europe's waiting. This country was not designed that way. And we have given, as a people, just in the decade I've been in the General Assembly, a steady flow of erosion of our personal liberties and individual freedoms and just giving them up.
You said the Homeland Security was actually started by George Bush.
It was.
And that this is where part of the issue with the gun control, or as we're now calling it, gun safety, is coming from.
Well, two things started under Bush in his domestic policies that I absolutely disagreed with. And one was the Education Act that he did, No Child Left Behind, and the other was the Patriot Act. And I understood what parts of the Patriot Act were designed to do, but I could see where it could go with personal liberties. Let's see where we are today with the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act laid the groundwork for Homeland Security. Homeland Security was authorized to have a national police force. Jesse Jackson was just shouting over the weekend from the rooftops for the Homeland Security police force to take the streets of Chicago because the Chicago Police Department didn't have control of the streets. Heck, and they have never had control of the streets. Al Capone had control of the streets of Chicago in the 30s. So what's
new? Different, right? Except I think people are getting killed left and right, and it's just out of control, totally out of control.
Well, taking that into connection with the Second Amendment issue, where do you think the two most violent parts, or the two most violent areas of our nation are? Where do more gun crimes occur than any other part of our nation? Number one and number two.
Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C.
Oh, good guess, Ann.
And Chicago.
And Chicago.
Which two areas have the most stringent gun control measures in the nation?
Washington, D.C. and Chicago.
Washington, D.C. and Chicago. You couldn't have a gun inside the Beltway until the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that it was unconstitutional to deny you the ability to protect yourself. You could not have a gun inside the Beltway until that decision was made. And it led the nation, and still does, in violent crime and murders committed with a gun, assault committed with a gun. What that's telling me very clearly is, if only criminals have guns, you're going to pay the price. The law-abiding citizen's the one paying the price. There are enough gun laws on the books right now, if they are enforced, to deal with gun issues. What we don't do a good job of dealing with are mental health issues.
Well, that opens up a whole nother, goes through another door here. You know, we used to have state institutions. We used to have a place. And, you know, I think the problem is we don't have that anymore.
No, we don't. Jeff Duncan and I had this very conversation this morning, that at one time we did have state institutions. And through a Supreme Court ruling on a case out of Florida, it was deemed unconstitutional to commit someone against their will. So our state institutions went away. There are people out there that have mental health issues to the point that they are a danger to the rest of society. But if there is not a crime committed, then you have a problem. And now we have nowhere to put them. The reason the conversation occurred between Jeff and myself today was we both agree that it would be a good thing to support the building of a mental health institution similar to the old state hospital in our state with a new bond bill at some point.
What's the possibility of that happening, though?
Well, The possibility is good. The probability, I'm not sure, especially with the economy where it is right at this time. But that's one thing. And we also discussed, okay, how do you approach the ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court on that issue? That would take federal legislation. And
I think that would be very tough, and particularly with the HIPAA laws. And, you know, how many times do you hear of somebody that knows that somebody is about to explode, that somebody is having real issues, and yet there isn't any place to turn to. Well, these are some of the questions that I just have a problem. I mean, it's not right to know that somebody is going to explode, or that they're talking conversation or having conversations or doing things on the internet. All these things, we have ways to know this, and somebody else always knows.
That's the common denominator that these tragedies have.
Yes.
It's people that were on the peripheral of the mental health system. The Virginia Tech shooter, two professors had reported him, and numerous students had reported mental issues to school authorities.
Yes.
But there was no way to intervene because he had not committed a crime. And when he did, it was a horrible, horrendous crime.
Sure. The guy with the movie theaters.
The Connecticut shooting. The military shooting. Nobody's talking about the military base shooting at Fort Hood, Texas.
Kyle? No, you're talking about the other one.
Little different case, because this guy, it's hard to tell how much of it was mental and how much of it was jihad.
Right.
But with these others, there's a clear common denominator, and that's that they were on the peripheral. Some had been in and out of the mental health system, but none of them had been deemed a serious threat and had been adjudicated that way.
And not only that, when you have somebody that's on medication, they're fine when they're on the medication, but maybe they don't like the side effects of the medication. Things start happening, so they just quit taking their medication, or maybe they can't afford their medication.
Well, and we talked at the very beginning of the show about the budget and what it, where the money goes, health care and public education. Mental health is part of that system that is definitely underfunded. And when you look at it, it has two issues. One is it's a large system that is just now coming under very good direct supervision. Dr. McGill, our state director, is an excellent individual, and I hope we can keep him where we have him because he is very good at what he does. But it is an underfunded system. And when you look at it in comparison to medical health or physical health issues, it's not funded the same by insurance. It's not looked at the same way, but it can sure create problems. Now, here's where I tie it in. When the problems that mental health creates are the problems that not properly funding and looking at mental health create is a public safety issue.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think the other thing is, back in the day, psychiatrists, people spent the time trying to figure out. Now we just medicate people. That's all we do is medicate. There is no resolving it, if there is a way to resolve it.
Well, they medicate kids. When I was a young fella, we had a lot of good athletes in my class going through school. So they were type A personalities, a lot of alpha males in that class. And they all, each and every one of them, turned out to be good athletes. At that point in time, we had a trip to the superintendent's office, a trip to the principal's office, corporal punishment, and back to our room if we misbehaved. Sure. Now they would simply medicate them to a point that they were like Jack Nicholson and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
That's just not the right way to go.
No, it's not.
Why do we do it then?
It's a matter.
Why do we do it, Mike?
A matter of convenience.
Yeah, that's why medication is they use medication rather than all these other avenues that are at hand.
Now, there are people that respond well to medication, and that's not the person that I'm talking about. There are a lot of people that are in the mental health system that are prescribed medication by a psychiatrist or a clinical psychologist, and they do very well.
Sure.
And as long as they take the medication, they function normally. And
that's the key. As long as they take the medication.
Then there are people that out there that, even with the medication, sooner or later, they can drift off into a bad situation.
What do you think is the answer on gun control, gun safety? Bullets, kits, semi-automatic, you know, what is the answer on this? Where do you think this is going to end up?
Where do I think it's going to end up?
Mm-hmm. Is there going to be any change?
I think the change will be minimal when President Obama lays out an aggressive plan, and if a blind man could have seen this coming, but if when he lays out a plan and Harry Reid, arguably his most stringent supporter in Washington, mm-hmm. and absolutely his most ardent supporter in the Senate, says no to his plan, and then the Supreme Court says if the Feinstein law passes, it's unconstitutional. I think being overly aggressive and submitting to knee-jerk overreaction is going to get us nowhere. But there is solid dialogue and ways to get into it. And one is the background checks. I don't have a problem with background checks. But where the problem comes in with background checks is if you say that every transaction has to be a background check, then how do you do the background check if I give my son a hunting rifle for Christmas? And then you got issues like Feinstein's law or bill, that if it becomes law, the .22 repeating rifle that my grandfather left to me now becomes an illegal weapon. And that's ridiculous. So it's going to have to be a debate that focuses on sensible solutions and not extremes on either side.
What do you think about resource officers or armed guards in the schools? And is that something that would happen here in South Carolina?
Yes, it is. Again, it goes back to the issue of how do we fund it. But school resource officers are a good thing. I met with the director of SLED this week, and he was headed to a conference on this very issue of how do we provide security at our schools. And he and I will meet again within the next couple of weeks to take a look at what we're going to do. I gave him an idea to look at, patterned after the Sky Marshal program. And being a retired law enforcement officer, I the last time I went into a school was at my granddaughter's Christmas play at a public school in Lawrence.
Sure.
And that was right after the Connecticut incident. So I look around and I'm thinking, if something goes bad with this number of people, what would you do? How do you approach it? And it became less and less defensible the more and more people that came into the room. And I saw how it could create havoc. And I said, this has to be stopped at the door.
Mm-hmm.
It can't be stopped once it penetrates.
Once people are in.
It needs to be stopped at the door. Now, there are two things that you could do. One is you make it a compound. Every school becomes a compound, one way in, one way out. And if you did that, who would be the more appropriate to put it at that than former military policemen?
Mm-hmm.
They are trained to perceive a threat and engage the threat very quickly. But
what would be the other option?
The other option, patterned after the Sky Marshal program, was when was the last time you flew in?
Probably been a year. It's been a year.
When you got on the plane, was there a Sky Marshal on it?
I don't know.
Was there two on it?
I don't know.
Was there any on it?
I don't know.
If there was, who was it?
I don't know.
There you go.
Right.
And the terrorists don't either.
Well, what about having teachers carrying concealed weapons?
That is a huge debate, and some teachers want to. I think someone in the school needs to be able to defend themselves and protect those kids, whether it's a teacher, whether it's the coach, whether it's staff. I think that's open for debate. And it would be, if you're going to say that teachers could carry with a concealed permit, it needs to be much more instruction than the concealed weapons permit course does. I teach that course. That's a basic course. You would need to be taught to a much, much higher level. Then you've got people out there that scream and say, we don't even want police officers having a weapon in the school system. Well, I heard a lady being interviewed the other day, and you want to talk about absence of reality, just absolute absence of reality. This lady said you should issue pepper spray and a taser. Now, it's very difficult to engage someone that's shooting at you when you have the ability to shoot back.
Hard to get close with the pepper spray there, isn't it, Mike?
If I'm within pepper spray distance or taser distance, I'm probably not in with the ability to use it, if
right.
You know what I mean. But that absence of reality is a problem. We have an area in the state where off-duty police officers said, we will come to the school and make a visible presence at the school. There were parents that protested and said, we don't want that perceived level of authority in front of the school. We don't mind plain clothes, and we don't mind unmarked cars. Well, that goes against what the law enforcement officers were trying to do. So it's a difficult equation.
It is a difficult equation, but there has to be an answer, and there has to be one that can stop this, because it seems to be picking up pace.
Well,
across the country.
My answer is one that some people don't like. My answer is you meet force with force. My answer is there's a reason that a person like the Connecticut shooter or the Virginia Tech shooter go to a gun-free zone and shoot innocent people. They know that no one there is going to shoot back.
Exactly. So,
have you read Killing Lincoln?
No, I have not.
You should read it and think about it in terms of the discussion that we just had.
I will.
John Wilkes Booth could have very easily been one of those shooters of today.
Wow. And here we sit today. How many years later? Why do we keep going through this? Why can't we make decisions that, I put a lot of it on the internet and our media. I think people, I think when you think back in, what was it, 1987, I think it was, Jamie Wilson in Oakland over here.
Mm-hmm.
And now the speed that these things keep happening, don't you think some of it has to do with media and with the internet and all this connectedness that we have?
You can't desensitize people the way we have for two generations and not expect problems. Seeing violence and sex on public television, not the movie screen,
right,
but public television, is not for 5-year-olds.
No, it's not for 5-year-olds. And a lot of the violence, and you watch these kids playing these games, and of course, at the end, they get up and go on, don't they? They haven't really killed them, even though they've killed them.
That's exactly right, and that's what I was talking about. And you mentioned the Super Bowl. I quit watching the Super Bowl. Didn't watch this one. I couldn't tell you who won. I have no idea. I haven't watched news or sports today, so I don't know who even won the Super Bowl.
The Ravens.
Oh, well. Well, that would be legitimate.
Okay.
I told my wife asked me, why are you not watching the Super Bowl? I said, I'd just as well be watching WWF. It's become the Super Bowl. Pro football to me has become as big a soap opera as WWF. Why do I say that? Well, the big hype after the hurricane hit New Orleans. New Orleans won a Super Bowl. Well, New Orleans was 500 at best prior to the Super Bowl win, 500 after the Super Bowl win. Somebody had a good script writer. Then you go to the two brothers, one for Dallas, one for the Jets. right. going up against each other. Then you had the Manning brothers quarterbacking against each other in the Super Bowl. This week it was the
coaches,
the yep. Harbaugh coaches, yep. and it was a great send-off for
Ray Lewis.
Ray Lewis. It's WWF with pads on.
Well, there you go, folks. You heard it right here from our own Mike Pitts right here on WCRS. Hey, Mike, you know, we've talked about a lot of different things. Is there one issue we should have discussed that we haven't discussed here this afternoon or you'd like to say a few words about?
Yeah, we've been discussing mandates. I'm serving on
mandates, and we're going to discuss that one minute. Let me just give an ID, and we're going to go right on. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. I have to say I don't understand this mandate thing that well, and you have on a committee that you're working with, right?
That's correct, and it was actually a committee that I asked for indirectly, and it concerns local government and the funding to local government, both in education and to the local government entities, municipal and county. And I hear the term mandates, unfunded mandates, underfunded mandates over and over and over, so I started asking, what are they? Tell me what those mandates are.
This had to do with the fairness, didn't it, between the state giving money and this type of thing?
Well, it had to do with funding in general and cuts to funding. The state has suffered severe cuts since the recession of 08. So naturally, some of those cuts had to be passed down to who we send money to, which was the local government. And what I asked for was a list of the mandates. If you can show me the mandates, some of them are antiquated. And that's what we found out in our first meeting, that my suspicion was correct, that some of these were antiquated. And by simple elimination of those antiquated mandates, you give flexibility back to local government. They're not required to fund something that is unnecessary. So we are in the process, working with the Association of Counties and others, working through that process to identify unfunded and underfunded mandates, which can give us the ability to more effectively align funding for those entities.
Gracie, come over here. Gracie, that's right. So, and hopefully this will make it so that cities and towns can get what is necessary and maybe cut out some of the things that aren't necessary or antiquated.
That's correct.
That's right. Hey, you know what? I'm Ann Eller. Gracie has just come in. She said, Ann, it's time for you to be off the radio. So I guess we'll just call it quits here today. Mike Pitts, it is always a pleasure to have you here.
It's always a pleasure to be here, Ann. You always ask the pointed and hard questions without being offensive, and I appreciate that.
Thank you very much, Mike Pitts. That's going to do it for us. This is WCRS right here in Greenwood. Gracie, you got anything else you want to say here this afternoon? Yeah, man, I got to go. Bye-bye, everybody.